Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 342. Welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Tirillo, and I serve as pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And as most always, Rob McKenzie is with me. Rob serves as an elder at Westminster. And hey, Rob, how's it going today? Are you keeping warm?
Mostly keeping warm because I'm inside.
Yes.
And keeping warm because it is no longer -9.
Yes, we've had a brisk start to this new year. I'd say it's been a bit chilly in our neck of the woods. Although for probably the majority of the people who might listen to us, if they're anywhere in the South, they probably still have no power when we're recording.
Yeah,
they went through a huge storm.
Yeah.
A couple million people without power. So, wowzers. We didn't lose any power. We just have cold.
Yeah, we lost power.
Did you?
Not for long.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
We did. But it wasn't for very long. But what it did, maybe half an hour, it was probably out. But we actually have a generator, so it
sure
kicked in.
Oh, good.
What it did is it reset all these settings that we had on
sure
different things. So at one point, our heat actually went out, or our furnace,
mm-hmm,
because it tripped something. So we woke up to a very cold house the next day with the, I hope we can get our heater going.
Yes, and I hope, you know, because when the problem with heat going out or the electricity going out in really such cold temps is then pipes freezing.
Yeah.
I'm thankful. I didn't hear anything from you that your pipes froze. Okay, good.
No, we were able to... we had to reset it. We had to do a couple different settings, and then there's other things that you forget. You put something at a certain setting.
Yes, yeah.
And you forget about it.
Of course.
And then it gets tripped, 8 months later, and it's like, what did we do
again? Yeah, and that's where my notes app has come in very handy recent years, of just the things I forget about, and I can always go back and just do a quick search.
Oh, you and your newfangled computer.
I know. I'm so reliant. I mean, otherwise, I would write it down, and then I would lose that sheet of paper. Or I'd have it in a stack.
Just remember it.
Yeah, that's the problem, though. Remembering, that's something that we Christians have always had a problem doing. Not just the little menial things, but the big things, too. That's why God's always saying, remember!
That's why we have four Gospels.
Of course. It's the only reason we have four Gospels. Just to remember. No. But it's beautiful now. We're going to be, sticking around at the low 20s, mid 20s for, a couple of weeks, according to the forecast. And that's better than zero and negative. So it's
right,
like we're sunbathing out there. It's a sunny day. And
yeah. Well, we did get down to -9. What about you way up there in the north?
It was in the, I don't know if it got down to -9 in real temp. Maybe -5. I don't remember the lowest, but it was below zero. But when it's below zero and it's not windy, it actually doesn't feel that crazy bad. It's when and especially when it's been sunny. It has been sunny during the day, and that's been really nice. But when that wind blows, that's when it just it just cuts right through.
Yeah.
And you try to. My dog does not wear a jacket. She doesn't, I see dogs out there wearing booties and a jacket. And we have, don't tell me I'm a bad dog parent. You're as the dog parents out there saying, oh, bad. We've tried, and she just will not wear, she's a beast, right?
I know. You can't.
You can't tame this beast. She won't walk in them. She'll just stand there and like, I don't know what these things are. And she looks like a really funny dog when she has them on her. So when we try to take her for a walk, she'll get, around the block, and then she's lifting her paws up and she can't handle it. And we'll put moisture, the stuff that protects her pads and everything. So, no one gets a walk. If she doesn't go for a walk, we don't go for a walk. Because, I don't know who's walking who sometimes when we take the beast out.
And that's why I've got cats.
Yeah, because you take your cats for walks.
Right. Yes, that works. We're
or is it just the opposite?
It's just that we don't have to take them for walks.
No, that's right.
That's.
But she just, you know, now she's stir crazy because while she's 8 years old, she is still loves to run. And I think she's outside right now. So,
oh, is she?
Yeah, I might need to put it on pause just to go get her. But it's sunny out and she's running mm-hmm. around and she's doing her beastie things in the backyard, chasing rabbits that come in. I don't know why they come in, but yeah, there's rabbit droppings all over our backyard, just loving our backyard for some reason.
Well, there were no droppings until the rabbits saw the dog.
That might very well. I don't know. There's something about our backyard that they probably have put a few more little baby rabbits back there, and they're hunkered down mm-hmm. for the winter, and they've done that before, and Tippy finds them, so and she kind of plays with them, and then their necks get broken. And oh, I shouldn't be saying this online. All wow. our kids, all our wow. Those that welcome have our children listen. She is really a beast. Come and
welcome to CSI Chicago.
Wow. Sorry, buddy. Getting off topic here, but that's not nothing not normal.
So speaking of necks being broken, Babylon.
We're talking about Babylon still, yeah, aren't we? Yes.
Talking about Babylon.
Sorry, I'm still not used to my camera keeps going in and out on me, and I don't know how to stop this. It's like an auto.
I know. I'm kind of used to it now.
What's
I'm
that?
I'm used to it now. It's
I like laugh and I back up like way back here and then I come forward and it.
Right. Zoom. There you go. Every now and then it's like you're about to, it's like you've got a button and you're about to make some sort of dramatic
hands
point.
Free.
You push the button. And it zooms in on your face, even though I'm the only one that's seeing you.
I am not doing this on purpose. It's AI stuff, and I don't know if it's Zoom or if it's my computer. I don't know what's going on here. Sorry, everybody. Little technical faux pas going on. But we're talking Daniel 5 today, right?
Yep, Daniel 5, yeah. So we've moved on from Nebuchadnezzar. It's really interesting that Nebuchadnezzar ends with this declaration of the superiority of the true God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not he was converted, we can't say for sure.
Right.
I think there's a lot of evidence that he was, but there's some historical notes on the rest of his life that you think, well, he couldn't have been converted. But I just don't think we know.
Yeah, nor do I think we need to know. This is a Gentile pagan who is, while he may or may not be converted, he is extolling the name of God, and he is being lifted up before the nations that he rules, and he is putting out decrees for all of the people of his empire to honor this God of Daniel and of the Jews. And so that in and of itself is I think, the point. And for those who exalt themselves to be humbled before the Lord. And that's exactly what happens, right? Nebuchadnezzar is completely humbled before the Lord for a period of time. And as a result, he praises and extols and honors the King of Heaven for all his works and right, for all his works are right and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Mm-hmm. And that's not from the mouth of Daniel. That's from the mouth of Nebuchadnezzar,
right,
the one who conquered the Jews and brought them into captivity. It's just, I said, and I think it was toward the last episode, it's just simply stunning what the Lord does here. And then, as you said, we're done with him. He's just gone. He's off, out of the picture.
But oddly enough, he ends on a good note.
Oh yeah,
The good note involved him becoming a beast or like a beast for maybe 7 years, seven times.
Yeah,
and that's the good note. But it's what he declares afterwards. I mean, there's several things going on in these first four chapters. One is what's happening with Nebuchadnezzar himself. What's happening with Daniel? What's happening with, at some point, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the people of God. But there's also God using Nebuchadnezzar and his dreams to twice give two different, very distinct illustrations of the kingdom that's coming, of what's going to happen to the kingdom. And part of that has to do with Nebuchadnezzar and him being cut down, there being a stump, but of course he'll be restored. But then we have the very large statue that's the dream. And then the statue that's actually put out, you know, this is where Nebuchadnezzar's like, oh, this is great. I'm the head of gold. I'm going to make a statue all of gold, and I'm going to put that out. And of course, that leads to problems for the Israelites to worship an idol. And but there's other things that's happening, and we're going to get into that in a minute as far as this chapter goes, because this is kind of the odd chapter in the book, where you have these four chapters on Nebuchadnezzar, everything that's going on, and then this one chapter on what happens to Belshazzar, and then we go into the Medes and Persians coming in and Daniel's visions and all that. And it almost seems like this chapter is odd. Like it doesn't fit.
In that way, it's kind of like a transitional chapter, right? Because it moves us from the ruling parties of Babylon to the Medes and the Persians. Mm-hmm. And it moves us through a good deal of history. That connects Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar, which we have to be careful. Belshazzar is the king. Belteshazzar is Daniel, it's a very similar name. Belteshazzar is Daniel, and that's the name that Nebuchadnezzar gave him after one of their gods. Belshazzar is the next king that we are made aware of. Now, he's not actually the next king. He's not Nebuchadnezzar's immediate son. So there is a little bit of time here. And if just for the sake of getting a little bit of the history in front of me, I got what I thought was a helpful quote here from an author that, let me see if I can get his name real quickly. Alan Harmon, in a study commentary on Daniel in the Evangelical Press series. And he says, there's no introduction, no explanation given for the sudden shift in the narrative. And that we've just acknowledged. It's a big sudden shift. It's a different thing that we're dealing with. It moves pretty quickly. And he writes, Nebuchadnezzar dies in 562 BC and was succeeded by his son, Merodach, best known as the monarch who released Jehoiachin of Judah from confinement. You can see that in 2 Kings 25. He was followed by his brother-in-law, Labashi Marduk, who in turn was succeeded by Nabonidus, after he led a successful coup in 556 BC, to Belshazzar, he entrusted the army and the day-to-day running of the empire, especially when he spent 10 years in a self-imposed exile at Tema. Belshazzar was killed when Babylon fell to Cyrus in 539 BC. So that gives you just a little bit of the movement. So when you read that, which you see a few times in chapter 5, Belshazzar was the son of, or Nebuchadnezzar is the father of Belshazzar. We need to keep in mind that father can mean successor. It can mean, you know, grandson or great grandson. It doesn't mean an immediate lineage like I would say my father is. And that really means who my direct dad was in our context and our language of father. And so we have to just keep that in mind in ancient Near Eastern times. Father, like Abraham, Av doesn't mean direct lineage in the sense of he was my papa.
Right. Yeah, that's very true in the ancient culture that you can refer to your father, but it's actually your grandfather, your great grandfather, and
or even further back, right? I mean, Father Abraham. Right. The Jews were saying,
right. Yes,
you know, yes. It's just yes. Who you descended from. Right. So, And it can even be through an in-law, which, because one of those was an in-law there. So it's just something to keep in mind that we're dealing with actually a little bit more history than you would think straight away, because it goes from Nebuchadnezzar, and we don't know how many years exactly, at least as you read, it goes from Nebuchadnezzar directly then to Belshazzar. And a bit of time has taken place. And in that time, the Medes and the Persians have begun to rise. And I think even as we get started here, if you don't mind, another quote from me, not from me, from the same author, you get to the end of this chapter, which I don't know if we're getting to the end of this chapter.
No, we're not going to make it to the end of the chapter.
Okay. But I want to just put this out there, you know, because it's historical. At the end of the chapter, you see that because it is transitional, you see the Medes and the Persians are coming in. You know, what Daniel tells Belshazzar as an interpretation of the handwriting on the wall, Belshazzar dies at the end. But what we read here, is that there's the feast is going on, but while this feast is going on, they just come back from a pretty bad defeat not too long ago, and the Medes and the Persians are 50 miles away. They're not far. And so that's sort of the background when you get into, one of the things that you see straight away is that Belshazzar is in the midst of a feast for what's described as 1,000 of his lords drinking wine in front of the 1,000. So that's the background of, and we'll get, I think we'll get more into this as we talk. Yeah. I think I'm getting ahead of myself, so sorry about that, Rob.
That's okay. No, that's okay. Just real quick to wrap up Belshazzar.
Yeah, yeah.
And, his, it used to be people would criticize the Bible because they would say there's no historical evidence for Belshazzar. And then in the late 1800s, they found some cuneiform evidence, a cylinder and a fragment of a record that talks about Nabonidus, who is Belshazzar's father. And again, how the actual relationship is there. That's what we're told, though. But Nabonidus was the actual king, and the problem was he was actually very intellectual, and he was very much interested in restoring the lineage back to the ancient times, back to Ur, actually, where Abraham was from. So going back to the history of Babylon. But also, it's really interesting to me that he had chosen to represent the moon god, who is, oddly enough, named Sin. And that is because the king of Babylon is supposed to represent Marduk, who is the he's the highest in the pantheon. He's the one who, when he came into being, made a deal with the other gods that there's chaos that was ruling, and he would destroy the chaos and bring order if they would then be subservient to him. Now, going back to Nebuchadnezzar, who was very clearly the representative of Marduk, it's interesting that we leave it off with him saying that there is this God in heaven and on earth, and his will is paramount. That he is brought down, that Nebuchadnezzar is humbled, and he is recognizing the Hebrew God as the God of the universe that is in complete control. And that's where we're left in chapter 4. And so within Babylon, after Nebuchadnezzar dies, his successor, Nabonidus, taking on that persona as the moon god is a very interesting switch. I don't want to go beyond too much speculation. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go beyond scripture, but it could be. So here is just speculation, but it could be that because Nebuchadnezzar had actually downplayed the role of the Babylonian gods and uplifted the God of the Israelites, that his successor was now trying to once again rebuild that the religion. The problem was he didn't take Marduk as his persona, which angered the religious priests within Babylon. He also wasn't a very strong military leader. He didn't. He was more interested with peace and rebuilding. Like, he rebuilt a lot within the city of Babylon. He did a lot of architectural builds and things like that. So he was kind of chased out. And Belshazzar is put into his place, and which actually answers a question for us in chapter 5. That's why I'm talking about all this.
Yes, I gathered. Yeah.
In chapter 5, he says to Daniel, whoever's going to tell me the interpretation of this writing on the wall, I will make third in the kingdom. Well, if he's king, why wouldn't he make Daniel second in the kingdom, such as like what happened with Joseph?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because his father is somewhat exiled. It was kind of a
he's still around.
Was still the king, but he placed his son to be in Babylon to appease the people, the religious class and the military class, while he went off. And I think he went to Tima.
Yeah.
And he was in Tima. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I read was that Nabonidus entrusted the army and day-to-day running of the empire, especially when he spent 10 years in self-imposed exile in Tima. So that's Nabonidus. And you helped clarify that, because that pronoun there wasn't actually the most clear. Spent 10 years in self-imposed exile. So that's what you're referring to.
Yes.
Nabonidus was not as well liked, is what you're saying.
No. Yeah. No. And then we don't know what happens to him. There's all this speculation. But again, because of that, you know, the higher critic, German higher critics and that, and the liberals of the 1800s were saying, see, this proves the Bible's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the problem with things like this, because I'm talking about evidentialism in one sense. Now there's archaeological evidence, which is great. And as a presuppositionalist, I have no problem with using evidences. But if that's the foundation of your apologetic, it's a double-edged sword. Because if you don't find evidence...
Yeah, well when critics use lack of evidence... lack of outside scripture evidence as their only argument, or as the basis of their argument. I mean, they did the same thing with the House of David. For a long time, I don't know exactly, higher criticism said that argued that David, there's no proof that David existed outside of the Bible.
Yes.
So... There's no reason to think that he's real. And then evidence was found in Israel at one point that referenced the Beit David, the House of David. And so it's a very, very dicey place to lay your foundations when, well, there's no archaeological evidence, therefore the Bible's wrong. That's quite foolish to argue that way. But it goes a long way in some, or I don't know if it does anymore, but it did in some scholarly debates at that time. If you don't see the evidence, then it didn't happen. Okay, well, I just walked behind you. Did you see me? Anyway.
Right. I mean, yeah, we shouldn't. I mean, by all means, when we find archaeological evidence, we should use it.
Absolutely.
But it's just the relying upon it. This is why there's so many expeditions to try to find the Noah's Ark. I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm serious. This is why it's an obsession with a certain segment of Christians.
Yeah. Well, finding it wouldn't do anything. It would just substantiate what we already know.
True.
Right.
Right.
And I mean, goodness, it'd be a really long time ago. That wood would have to. Well, I guess it was covered in tar and such. So.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought when Noah and his family get off the ark,
they'd make use of it.
I mean, he built an altar, and where do you think he got the wood from to sacrifice the animals? I mean, probably the ark. You know,
it would make sense for him to make use of that really good, what was it, gopher wood? And all the good wood that he had. I mean, the thing was huge, and I mean, he's got to build a place to live, and it's not as though trees just sprang up out of nowhere. They were kind of waterlogged.
Yeah, they were pretty young, but but the thing is, you'll see these documentaries and on Noah's Ark, and you have Sherpas and that will show up with a bit of wood that's old, really old. And it's like, well, this must be from Noah's Ark.
That sounds so much like relic hunting or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Roman Catholics have their relics and they search for these things, then this must be like the evangelical relic that people are looking for. You know, I got a piece of the.
Well, a lot of them see it as an evangelistic tool that if, because obviously they believe that it's not about them believing. They believe.
Sure. Yeah.
Just like we do that Noah's Ark was a real thing in it happened, but they really believe that if they find true evidence that cannot be in any way explained away, then it will lead to mass conversions.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought the gospel was what led to mass conversions, but I understand. I love archaeology. It's not something I followed since college, to be honest, but I enjoyed it in college, in my Old Testament courses and in seminary. And in fact, I was like, ooh, I wonder if I want to do this, you know, more in depth and focus on Old Testament scholarship and go in that direction. But obviously I didn't, but it only takes you so far. And you can enjoy these things, but it only takes you so far just because it's there. I mean, people that are like unbelievers believe that Jesus could have been raised from the dead. And that doesn't cause them to, they need a new heart and the findings of as cool as it would be to have Noah's Ark and to be able to walk through it, to see actually how it was built and all the details of it. That would be pretty, pretty, pretty neat. And I'm sure there'd be a lot of excellent observations and things found out about, you know, ark building or what have you from that era. To cause mass conversions, which would be wonderful if the finding of it helped people along the way. But that's setting your hopes on something that actually God hasn't asked us to set our hopes on.
Right. So just going back to the chapter, it just strikes me as a contrast between 4 and 5 and how you've gone from the king of Babylon declaring the God of Israel as in control of all things, and then we go to Belteshazzar. I know I keep saying
it. Belshazzar. Got to get rid of the T.
I don't know why the T's in there. Been listening to too many documentaries. Where, like you said, you were talking about this before, that the Medes and Persians have conquered a lot of Babylon, and they've just kind of defeated the army from Babylon and just suffered a big loss. But in Babylon itself, in the city, it is completely surrounded by a very high, very thick wall, and they in no way believe that the Medes and Persians can get over this wall and invade the city, and they're right. The Medes and Persians can't get over the wall. It is too high. It is too thick to chisel through. They have a very well-secured city, and so for them, you know, their faith, their hope is in what they've built, and in one sense. You know, they didn't get through yesterday, right? They didn't get through last week.
Yeah, yeah.
We're fine. And then he throws a drunken party.
Yeah, yeah. It's a false sense of security, right? That I think, I mean, yes, they have a high wall. They have a thick wall. But they're saying my wall and my gods are my refuge and my strength, right? Mm-hmm. And the contrast is real between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, and it's as before. It's like, you know, the Egyptians transitioning and forgetting about Joseph. It's the transition of power and forgetting about Daniel and Daniel's God.
Yeah.
And as you were saying earlier, well, there's this, you know, desire by the leadership to turn back to the old ways and where we found our security before, where we conquered lands beyond expectations. You know, we need to get back to the good old days. We're the conservatives of, you know, that wasn't a political statement. It was, yeah. it was just being strange, Bob. And silly. No, I mean, because they need to hold on to, the ways of the Babylonians. We can't, you know, move in the direction of some strange and foreigner's God, as you were saying. And that's what they're doing, right? They hold this feast, and it's a huge feast, right? We don't have to necessarily think it's exactly 1,000 people. It's a large number in a large area. And this is what Belshazzar is doing. He's having a blast. They're drinking wine and drinking wine to the to just beyond measure, and they're taking out the temple items to do it. They're drinking from Jerusalem's temple and the gold implements from the temple, and they're making use of all of these things that were the booty of conquering Jerusalem and Solomon's temple, and desecrating these holy items, and that, I mean, that's the one of the significant aspects of this passage as a transitional passage. First of all, that we've already noted, as the forgetfulness of Belshazzar and the things that have come beforehand. He knows about the things that went beforehand. We're told about that. That he knows what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He knows Nebuchadnezzar's decrees and the things that he has said about the God of heaven, the King of heaven. And he is either being purposefully forgetting these things or purposefully rebelling against such things like, the old fool, you know, that king did that, whatever the case might be. However that's being phrased, just ignoring those things. For probably political purposes, religious purposes. And so like the confrontation between Moses and Pharaoh, the confrontation, which isn't as much of a confrontation, but the interaction between Belshazzar or Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel is emblematic of the foreign gods, the idolatry, and the one true God. That's the confrontation that's taking place. That's the interaction that's going on here. And that's important for us to see that the spiritual dimension going on for this kingdom that is going to follow after the way in which God said it was going to follow after. It will come to an end. It's not under Nebuchadnezzar's reign. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is brought low and he's lifted up, but it will be under the reign of Belshazzar.
Yeah. So you've given us the setting, and here he is in the throne room, drinking from the vessels from the temple, and this finger appears, and it's interesting because there's always been, or what we've had in the past with Nebuchadnezzar, were these dreams. And this is not a dream, but he was probably so drunk that maybe he wasn't really sure what he was seeing. But everybody, I mean, that's one reason why I think that we're told that 1,000, you know, of his, you know, it's like all of his leaders were there. And so did it have to be exactly 1,000? No, it doesn't have to be, because that's kind of how they talked, where if everybody's here, there's thousands of people here. The same way we talk, like, oh, I've got a million things to do, that kind of a thing.
Right, right, yeah.
So you have so many witnesses to what's about to happen that this can't be wished away as, well, this, yeah, oh, sure, the king saw this finger appear. Yeah, I've seen how much wine he drinks. I'm sure he saw, was it a pink elephant, you know, in the room with him? But nobody can deny this, because the servants are there and the officials are there and the wives are there. And all these people see this finger right on the wall. And we're told that the king is so scared, so freaked out by this, that he trembles to the point that his knees are knocking together. Which, again, you know, this isn't something that, you know, did I see that? Am I really seeing this? He truly believes. He sees it. He sees this finger writing on the wall. And, of course, the problem after the finger's finished writing is that he doesn't know what it says. And so, of course, I'm sure there are a lot of things that are running through his mind of what it could be, which is why he calls for, and that, now we're getting some familiar territory. He calls for all the magicians and all the wise men of Babylon to come and tell him. But again, when they come, Daniel's not with them. And he's the chief wise man. So why isn't he with them? He's never with them.
Yeah, well, I mean, is he still the chief wise man? I'm looking at the passage. He had been made chief wise man, but it's been some years now.
Sure. He might not be.
I don't have an answer to why Daniel isn't with them, except for the forgetfulness of the people, right? Or Daniel just never seems to come when he's called.
He just doesn't. Yeah.
Like he needs to make, he needs to make an entrance. No,
yeah.
No. It's as though they're calling, a certain group of wise men, and they're listed, but Daniel doesn't quite fit into that same group for some reason.
It's kind of like nobody, like, call all the wise men, and okay, we'll call all the wise men. Okay, call all the wise men except that Daniel guy.
Yeah, it's we're not going to bring in. He always makes us look bad. A lot of people die because of the things he does.
That's a good point.
Who knows? But it is a peculiar thing that Daniel's called in separately these times. So they're in there, you know, having this feast, the handwriting on the wall. Persians and Medes are like at the proverbial doorstep, ready to conquer. It's pretty wild scenario. I mean, when you read descriptions, commentaries do a really good job of kind of trying to set the scene, and which is what I tried to do at some part, because Belshazzar is the one appointed over the armies and stuff, and he's the one who should be at the military head, trying to get the armies ready for this, for continuing the battle, where Nabonidus is, you know, off doing his scholarly thing in his exile, because, as you said, you know, the elites, the politicians, the military people, they didn't like his scholarly ways. But Belshazzar is flailing here at the moment, having a party to inebriate everyone, and to, this is all he can do, it appears. I mean, is that Nabonidus just, anyway, well, what I just read is that Nabonidus had fled from the last battle. Let me put this out there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start back just to give a little more context. The number 1,000 need not necessarily be exact in figure. We dealt with that, but can be understood as representative figure for an exceedingly large number. The most remarkable feature of the feast is not the number of those present, but the occasion. This is what I tried to set up. Just days previously, the Babylonians had suffered a great defeat at the hand of the Persians at Sippar, about 50 miles north of Babylon, and Nabonidus had fled. Now the Persians are at the gate of Babylon, and that very night Belshazzar is to die. That's in verse 30. Various explanations have been given of the event, but perhaps the best is linked to the defeat of Nabonidus. His flight gives Belshazzar the opportunity to proclaim himself as king, and he does so at a feast that is far more than just a social event. It is a celebration of his kingship, but one that may well have involved other elements. It might be, an attempt to quell the fear of the people and the city by proclaiming that life goes on as normal. Now, that's a assumption. It's an a way to explain the fact that there was just a pretty big defeat. Nabonidus is gone from the picture for some reason. Maybe he did fall there, and now Belshazzar is proclaiming himself king. It's not indicated, except in the fact that it's listed as King Belshazzar at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Now, I just did a quick, Google search. Belshazzar is not listed as the last king of Babylon. Right. Right. Nabonidus is.
Right.
So is it the fact that he is elevating himself as king, and that really the only record that we have is from Daniel? Maybe so. You know, no higher critic is going to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Is this where he is elevating himself as king? Is he trying to say, all is well, I have the army in hand, I have things under control, let's enjoy our feast? If that's the case, we don't know for certain, but it provides a certain sense of reasoning, whether, foolish in and of itself,
yeah,
because he finds, as you were saying, the walls of Babylon to be the most secure in all of that part human history,
And they were.
And they were. But that same night, the walls are breached, right?
Right. Well, yes, but
in some fashion.
In a fashion. We'll talk about that next week.
You always want us to put off things.
I know. The Nabonidus fragment tells us that Nabonidus, when he left, that there was this deal made that he would lift up his son to reign as king in Babylon. And he, you talked about the self-imposed exile, mm-hmm, in Timah. I mean, that's where, but they were both considered king.
Right, then, hence the third of what you referenced.
Right, hence
earlier.
The third.
Sure.
Right, so it's fine for him to talk about himself as king, and that's part of the reason why, the fact that when you look at these lists of kings, Belshazzar is not on it, is because the Babylon falls.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would if Babylon hadn't fallen in 100 years later. When Nabonidus died, then Belshazzar's name
listed.
He would have been listed.
I see.
But that's why we don't have that. And that's why the German Heider critics were looking at that list,
yeah,
saying, who is this guy? Obviously, right, this guy's made up.
Mm-hmm.
But their presupposition was
doubt
to make sure that they figure out everything. That's,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything in the Bible's made up.
Yeah.
What about this? Oh, well, sure. Maybe they took some historical facts. But so it's historically, what we see in chapter 5 here, who's ruling at the time, and with the evidence that we have from archaeology, it all matches. And so it's not – even today, I was watching a documentary, a recent documentary by a completely secular documentary. Even though the Nabonidus fragment, and there's also some other, there's a cylinder, there's other evidences of his life and the fact that his son was reigning in Babylon. This documentary never mentioned Belshazzar. They just totally overlooked.
Let's not worry about him.
Yeah.
We'd have to go to the Bible.
but you didn't have to, because it's on the fragment. He's on the fragment. And so, you don't have to mention the Bible. The problem is they know that once they talk about the fragment, then it proves that the Bible is actually historically accurate.
Yeah, then they'd have to go and talk about the Bible, which, yeah, they don't want to do.
No, they definitely don't want to do that. So we're the scene that we're then given is Daniel standing there in front of, because he doesn't come, and it's actually Belshazzar's wife that says, actually, there is somebody. She knew the records. She knew Nebuchadnezzar's chronicles, and she very well might have known Daniel. I mean, we don't really know much about her, except that
she's the queen.
She's the queen, and she knows about Daniel.
Yeah.
So he calls for Daniel. And just like Nebuchadnezzar is, he's like, hey, I just want to know. What does this mean? This is freaking me out, man. And I need to know. And if whoever can tell me, you know, you'll be third in the kingdom. I'll give you a gold chain. I mean, I'm going to set you up. And Daniel comes in, and it's really interesting because Jeremiah talks about the fall of Babylon in chapter, I think it's 50 and 51, where he talks about the army nations from the north coming and taking over Babylon. And I'm sure Daniel knew this passage. He knew the Jeremiah. Isaiah talks about it as well, mm-hmm. although that's a little more, probably a little more looking at it from a eschatological setting.
Yeah.
But still, he does talk about it. He does talk about the fall of Babylon. And Jeremiah is much more specific. So Daniel's coming in now, and he's about to give this. I mean, he probably knows what's about to happen before he even sees what's written. He knows that this will happen. Because with Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar was told, your kingdom will fall, or Babylon will fall, but it won't fall under you. And now he's gone. So Daniel must be coming in thinking, could this be the time?
Yeah. I mean, it could be this time, but I mean, did he know it was that night? I mean, that could be a different, that's a different
but I
topic.
Think he, yeah. But he, well, he might've been wondering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is this a night?
Sure. Certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's quite the scene. I mean, verses 13 and following, which I think is what we'll get to next time, you know, is the interpretation, the famous Mene Mene Tekel Parsin passage, which again is all a part of the interpretation. But you know, up to this point, we have the queen calling him in. You know, the king's colors changed. He's just really, really distraught. And you have all of these, like you said, magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Who have been brought in, but Daniel is the one with the excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems. I mean, he's just a general go-to guy.
Yeah.
He's the problem solver.
Yeah, everybody needs a Daniel.
Yeah. Now, let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. I mean, there's such confidence that this woman has in Daniel's abilities, and that's what happens.
It's one thing that we haven't gotten into, and we'll talk a little bit more about it next week, is the eschatological Babylon that we see as a theme throughout Scripture, henceforth. And we're going to talk about that a little more with the visions. But next week, I think it really comes into play, because you know, Babylon's about to fall,
mm-hmm.
right? It falls. Well, that theme, the fall of Babylon, is carried through. And the representation of Babylon as the kind of the representation mm-hmm. of the satanic kingdom's stronghold, the epicenter.
Yeah, yeah.
Is carried through.
It is, you know, it'd be great. I'm sure there's probably people have written on it. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that it's Babylon. It's not Assyria. Mm-hmm. It's not Persia, right? It's
not Egypt.
It's not Egypt. It's I mean, now there are hints of Egypt that's talked about, right? The mm-hmm. wicked cities and countries, empires are all talked about. Edom, right, is referenced. Of course, it's all about what Obadiah is dealing with, and Nahum is Nineveh. So they're there,
right?
But like you said, Babylon continues until the book of Revelation. And it's the fall of Babylon. It's Babylon the harlot. It's not, you know, Persia the harlot. But these other empires are just as you know, just as bad mm-hmm. and just as full of idolatry and such. So it is interesting that it's Babylon that is used. And this is, you know, Babylon is where Abraham came from.
Right.
It's a very interesting.
Yep.
Way that God has decided to mark and make use of empires and what they are meant to for us to understand through them, which I'm sure is something we can develop and has been developed theologically, a biblical theology or redemptive historical approach to understanding the theme of the fall of Babylon would be a very interesting read.
Yep.
Oh, it looks like that's all we got for you, folks. All right. Well, once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Listen, do go check us out at reformforum.org, because beyond the wonderful podcasts that you'll find there, Christ the Center,
the classes,
there's a new class. A new class by Lane Tipton is out, and you know, I don't have the website in front of me, but it's out. I've seen it posted on Facebook, and it's something that you should go check out. I haven't yet, but I'm sure it's good. Why? Because it is Dr. Lane Tipton.
He's incredible.
He's an incredible teacher, you just need to go check him out. Check it out, not him. Rob's just looking at me like, dude.
That went sideways quick.
Also, do go check out westminsteropc.org. You'll find out all sorts of wonderful things about our congregation there, the ministry that we have, not only myself as pastor, but Pastor David Wright serving as our evangelist, and the other ministries. If you're in our neck of the woods, do come and visit with us at westminsteropc.org. And, you know, what do we, I think I know what we're talking about next time, Rob, but anything special happening or just going straight on?
Well, Babylon's going to fall.
Babylon's going to fall. All right. I forgot what I was supposed to say.
Till next time.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. Another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.